So I'd like to describe an umbrella of Christianity. I believe under this umbrella there is Catholic and Orthodox and Protestant. A lot of modern megachurch non-denominationalists, sometimes they call them non-domers, they don't like the term Protestant because it sounds negative, and it is. But even if you look at National Geographic or any secular study of world religions or world history, under the title, under the umbrella of Christianity, there's really only three branches. It's Catholic and Orthodox and Protestant. All three of those have a Trinitarian confession. I would put as sort of satellites out there that don't even fall under Christianity, Jehovah's Witness and Mormon, because they don't believe in the Blessed Trinity. But under the title of Christianity, you have these three major ones, Catholic and Orthodox and Protestant. The Orthodox obviously broke off from the Catholics in about 1,000 years ago, and then Protestants off from the Catholics 5 years ago, and then they fractured in over 36,000 denominations. And so those are your three major ones. Now, of those Orthodox ones, of course, by the way, the Orthodox would say we diverted from the Church Fathers' teaching around 1055, and they maintained like the main branch of the tree, and we like broke off. But I think most of them, except for Mount Athos, recognize that we have valid baptisms, except for the monks on Mount Athos. So when you look at that break in 1055, the Orthodox churches, and by the way, Pope Benedict did point out, and I think it was Dominus Iesus, something he wrote about 10 years ago, we can't technically refer to Protestant communities as churches. We can refer to the Orthodox as churches because they have the seven sacraments and the and apostolic succession, but if you're actually talking about a community of Protestants, it's better to say community than church. I've fudged a little bit on that as far as like church buildings, you know, if I say that's a mega church there or something like that. But technically, those are communities, and the Orthodox have churches. Well, the good news is for those Orthodox churches, a lot of them came back into union with the church, rather the Catholic Church. And even though the ones that aren't in union with Rome still have apostolic succession, the seven valid sacraments, a valid priesthood, some of them have been able to keep their traditions of divine liturgy, even their doctrine, how they don't describe that the place of purification is purgatory. Basically, everything that was established in Turkey, or modern-day Turkey, rather, and Russia and Greece, all these Eastern churches that the apostles established and were in union with Rome and actually considered Catholic before 1055, and then they broke after 1055, there's a mirror image of all those Orthodox churches in the Catholic Church, and those we actually refer to as churches, too. So we actually have 24 churches in union with Rome. The Latin Church is one of those 24 churches, but we have 99% of the world's population. So you have one church, the Latin Church, with 99% of the world's Catholics is in the Latin Rite, R-I-T-E. The other 1% are dispersed through the 23 other churches, even under this aegis called Catholic. We're not even talking about Orthodox churches anymore. But for almost all these ones I'm about to name for you, there's an Orthodox church and a Catholic church. So these are the Albanian Greek church. And I'll just say Catholic church, but all these you could actually realize that there's an Orthodox church that's analogous to it in the world, but with a different hierarchy. So these are the 24. Albanian Greek Catholic Church, Armenian Catholic Church, the Belarusian Greek Catholic Church, the Bulgarian Greek Catholic Church, the Chaldean Catholic Church, the Coptic Catholic Church, the Eritrean Catholic Church, the Ethiopian Catholic Church, the Greek Byzantine Catholic Church, the Greek Catholic Church of Croatia and Serbia, the Hungarian Greek Catholic Church, the Italo-Albanian Greek Catholic Church, the Macedonian Greek Catholic Church, the Melkite Greek Catholic Church, the Romanian Greek Catholic Church, the Russian Greek Catholic Church, the Ruthenian Byzantine Catholic Church, the Slovak Byzantine Catholic Church, the Syriac Catholic Church, the Syriac Maronite Church, the Syro-Malabar Catholic Church, the Syro-Malankara Catholic Church, and the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church. What I love about all the liturgies is they all go back to about the first 500 years, as does our traditional Latin Mass. I've been to an Ethiopian one, and we were literally jumping over fire at that liturgy. And that works because that's traditional, and it's based in tradition, and it's ancient, and these go back to something apostolic. So as traditional Latin Mass Catholics, that doesn't mean we're against more colorful expressions of an apostolic faith, the Roman one took on a more sober approach because Romans at that time were very law-based, very kind of Cartesian in their thinking and grid patterns and just very clear thinking. And I think that was obviously the best church to evangelize the world since there was an airtight system of doctrine. But all these liturgies go back at least 1,500 years, and they're very beautiful. And actually, what we're going to be talking about in the Sung Mass is a big crossover. Like Pope Benedict said, that there's not even apostolic evidence that the priests ever faced the people in any of the catacombs in any of the Eastern churches. So if you go to any of those churches I just named, the priest will always have his back to you for all of those ancient liturgies, right? So you're going to see some crossover. Yes. So the question is, Pope Benedict at the time, Father Ratzinger, was at Vatican II. If later in life he admitted that there wasn't any apostolic evidence of the priest facing the people in the liturgy, why would he have signed off on Vatican II? And if you read the Ratzinger report that was published by Ignatius Press around 1982 or 1983, he answers that, and he basically says it was a failed council.
Father,
yes?
Because not all the participants in the council believed in the conclusion of the council.
Well, let's rewind. Even before the first week of Vatican II, even Archbishop Lefebvre seemed pretty excited about it. He signed off on the initial things. There was no problem with having a council, a pastoral council on how to reach the rest of the world. And bishops, really good Orthodox bishops, had been working for 2 years to get the documents together. So I'm not against the fact at all that there was a Vatican II. In fact, I think even Archbishop Lefebvre, weren't you telling me this earlier this week, Chris, that Lefebvre was okay with the first half of the Mass of the Catechumens being in the vernacular?
Yes.
You know, so it was like none of these people were curmudgeons just against any, because if you read the history of the church, there is room for flexibility. The problem is there was a small group of probably gay communists who had infiltrated in the very first weeks with an agenda where they literally trashed. I know all young people use literally as figuratively now, but like they actually trashed what these Orthodox bishops had put together.
All the research.
All the research. And so Cardinal Ottaviani took the microphone, and very humble but strong, well-spoken man, spoke in front of them about how, like, 2 years of research, I think this is what he was talking about, 2 years of research had been trashed, or not even trashed. He wasn't even using, like, extreme language. He was just questioning where things were going at that point. And they turned the microphone off. This is the first week of Vatican II. They turned the microphone off on him, and these guys laughed him out of the council. And so, you know, the way I describe it is, I'm not against the fact there was a Vatican Council at all, but there's a lot of evidence that the agenda was hijacked. And I don't know how else. I mean, I think you have to deny. I don't think that's schismatic to say that when you look at really what happened in that first week of Vatican Council II. This really does show that most of the bishops were good at that point. Like, they actually had a good intention for the church and a small group of people. And this goes back to that old line, like, that you saw people start saying in World War II, all that has to happen for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing. You know? And so the real sadness is not, there's always going to be a few rabble-rousers, troublemakers like those guys. The problem is that nobody blew the whistle on them and said, get out of here. Stop ruining the church. You know? And that, guys, that's why, you know, mother's job is to nurture, and why a man's job is to have this high-sighted view of the evil that can come into your family. And it's not to be paranoid, but, you know, to spiritually protect your family means to be very vigilant as far as what your kids are saying, they're listening to, who's talking to them. Again, I'm not saying be paranoid, but so much of it is to be smarter than the enemies of your daughters, you know. Because they're smart. And this is the same thing that happened in the church, is good men had a lack of vigilance. You know? Yes?
So Lefebvre
was... He was a missionary bishop for the white fathers in Africa who had probably converted under his belt, him and his priests, tens of thousands of Africans. And he wasn't considered by anybody at this point schismatic. He was just a very hard-working bishop who was invited to Vatican II, and he went, he showed up. I would even say he was excited for it from the little I understand. And he wasn't against it. He was even willing to understand there could be some organic development of the liturgy. Keyword is organic. When he saw it wasn't organic, but a total chop shop of everything, that's when he tried to start a traditional seminary just to maintain tradition. And he was under a lot of pressure for that. And then eventually he ordained some of those men without permission of Rome in the 1980s. So this was a building process. So, I mean, there's a lot of, this is a boiling point that took 20 years to reach. And then he was excommunicated by John Paul II for actually not ordaining priests. He consecrated bishops, which means ordained bishops, without the permission of Rome. But I think it's really interesting to go back to see what he was like in the 50s and 60s. Very joyful man, loved being in Africa. He wasn't, you know, before I watched the video on his life, I thought of him as just kind of a delicate, grumpy guy who wore white gloves everywhere and was, you know. But when I watched the video on his life, I realized he was today's the feast of St. Francis Xavier. He was a living St. Francis Xavier for Africa. I don't want to start a giant debate in here. I don't agree with his decision to consecrate bishops without Rome. I don't want to debate that right now. I don't think he should have done that, but I do think he was a good and holy man. And if I were Pope, I would certainly pardon him and possibly canonize him. But I would certainly pardon him for, I mean, I don't agree with what he did, but he was a saintly man, and I never would have said that in seminary. I saw him as bad as the liberals in seminary. So that's taken some research from me. I mean, I saw him as bad as the liberals in seminary, but when I finally watched... Yes, Ben?
What does canonize mean?
Canonize means when you're made a saint.
With Pope John Paul II,
yeah.
Having just read Lefebvre's book...
Yeah. Yeah, you just read the 800-page book, right?
The biography. I didn't realize this, but Cardinal Ratzinger, future Pope Benedict XVI, he was really the middleman between John Paul II and Lefebvre. And Cardinal Ratzinger took a really, really hard line.
Against Lefebvre?
Yes. I didn't realize that, but he did. He took a very, very hard line. And at least the way the book portrays him, John, who I happened to love, John Paul II, had a lot on his plate, not the least of which was he was trying, and he successfully, I would add, hastened the overthrow of communism throughout primarily Eastern Europe, and including his home country.
Yeah.
So he deferred a lot of these decision-making as far as handling Lefebvre to Ratzinger, and Ratzinger took a really, really hard line. That's the perception I got from reading the book.
Okay.
And I didn't realize that
until
I read the book. And I think the book was pretty objective about you know, portraying both sides.
Yeah, and you have to remember, like, I quoted last week Mouth of the Lion, that Brazil had a similar situation happening with Bishop Castro de Maier, Bishop of Campos, and it was almost the exact same story as Lefebvre, but John Paul II shut him down too. So I don't think he was totally ignorant of shutting down tradition in the world at the same time. The difference between what happened in Brazil and France is two things. In France, the SSPX priests spread across the globe. You can find SSPX priests in India, Africa, all over. In Brazil, they're all in one diocese still. The second thing that's different about Brazil is in 2001, John Paul II gave them canonical status and reconciled them all to the church. So now there's something called the Apostolic Association of St. John Vianney in the Diocese of Campos, Brazil. It's a very interesting situation because you have, I'm just making numbers up, but basically you have 100 parishes that are traditional Latin Mass parishes and 100 that are Novus Ordo. And I've been to Brazil three times. It's tube tops at Masses and goofy dance. I mean, it's just crazy. So imagine like 100 Fraternity St. Peter parishes, or like what we just had upstairs. Imagine if you had a parish with 100, a diocese rather. Imagine you had a diocese with 100 parishes that all had women in veils, and then 100 parishes with women in sandals and tube tops. Like, all in the same diocese. So it's a crazy diocese, and you can obviously guess which one's getting more vocations, right? So it's a really interesting book called Mouth of the Lion by David Allen White. And it's the Brazilian story of Archbishop Lefebvre. And actually, those two became friends, Castro de Maier and Lefebvre.
Mouth of the Lion, author, please.
David Alan White. He's an SSPX teacher at Annapolis. But again, remember, don't feel like, you know, if you're suspicious of SSPX, don't feel like you're schismatic in reading that book, because they all came back into union with Rome. John Paul II brought the Apostolic Association of St. John Vianney back into union with Rome. Castro's dead, but his major disciple, Rifan, R-I-F-A-N, is head of the order. And basically, he's the bishop. Actually, he is a bishop. Bishop Rifan, yeah.
So they've come back into union, because I had heard, mm-hmm. as of today, that if you went to an SSPX, you would be potentially committing mortal sin.
No, I said St. John Vianney's in union with Rome. SSPX is still canonically irregular.
So,
what does that mean?
Yes.
Okay, so Pope Benedict himself said that SSPX priests are not schismatic. Okay? You can't say that the people who go to those mass... See, a Catholic is either Catholic or not. The people who go to an SSPX parish are not schismatic because, well, for one, the priests are not schismatic. That's what Pope Benedict said, that they're not schismatic. Canonically irregular means they are not recognized by the bishop, and the bishop is the unchecked canonical juggernaut of the diocese who's in union with Rome, right? So SSPX has, I'm pretty sure they have a priest here at a place called St. Michael's, and he's validly ordained. Now I have to get into the definition of valid and licit. Valid means the sacrament took place. Licit means you were not naughty in doing it, for lack of a better term. So I'll explain that. Okay. Liceity is the noun that means it was legal, it was in union with Rome, it was a sacrament that was done in a full canonical status in union with Rome. Validity means the sacrament actually took place. Okay, so let me give you an example. In Denver, where I'm from, SSPX has an enormous church called, really, really beautiful, called St. Isidore's near Denver International Airport. They put as the cornerstone Archbishop Chaput, their bishop ordained me. He doesn't want his name on there because they don't answer to him. That's why they're canonically irregular. They have mass there. Even Archbishop Chaput, who likes them a lot less than me, would admit it's a valid mass. However, because they don't have permission for, say, a wedding, there's a question if those weddings are actually valid. Same with their confessions. There's been a question if they're valid. And because they don't have union with the bishop, if you ask an SSPX priest, well, if the bishop hasn't given you permission to hear confessions, how are your confessions valid? They would quote you St. Thomas Aquinas, who says, in a state of emergency or necessity, a priest can. And they say, because of the crisis in the church with how many people have left, we have necessity or emergency. Now, irony of ironies, and no one's going to understand this for 1,000 years, but the weirdest thing is Pope Francis made their confessions legal, of all people. Pope Francis said their confessions are now valid. So you can go to an SSPX priest for confession, right? Now, real quick, so if you go to their mass, and there might be people here who disagree with me, well, I don't want to have that debate, but I'm just going to tell you how Bishop Felipe sees it and how the Cardinals of Rome see this. They will say that their mass is valid but not licit. Licit means it's legal. It's done in a canonically regular... canonical is just the adjective that refers to canon law, meaning it's being done in a way that's in union with the bishop. So an SSPX mass is not licit, done in union with the bishop, but it is valid because he's a validly ordained priest. So some people would compare this to the Orthodox churches that I just got done talking about, right? The Orthodox churches are schismatic, but they still have apostolic succession and all the valid sacraments. Yes, Ben?
What does SSPX mean?
It means it's the Latin for the priestly fraternity of St. Pius X, because they cushion they place their conscience in Pope St. Pius X, who warned that the errors of modernism, he wrote that about 120 years ago, that, let me rewind, 120 years ago there was a pope named Pope St. Pius X, who said that there would be all these errors if we actually stopped our belief in divine revelation and started a man-based religion. And the people with SSPX believe that this man-based religion has really taken root in the church, and that their job is to preserve tradition of keeping a God-centered worship and a God-centered doctrine until the crisis in the church ends. So they've named their group, in fact, Archbishop Lefebvre named his group after Pope St. Pius X. Yeah, Damon?
So the reason I ask is, and this is your opinion, when we travel, we look for a Latin Mass.
Yes.
And it may or may not be obvious in what you're looking up whether or not they're SSPX. Mm. So I was concerned that should I be worried, like I shouldn't be attending, or are we in line, if we do, and whether we knew or not,
yes,
are we committing any kind of...
It's pretty easy to tell, though, if it's canonically regular or not. I mean, it's, you know, if you Google it, there's only three types of parishes that are going to be canonically regular. It's either going to be Fraternity St. Peter, or Institute of Christ the King, or what they used to call in the 1980s an indult mass, of the normal diocesan priest doing a mass like this, which we just had upstairs 30 minutes ago. And an indult mass... is going to be on the normal parish website, and you can see that's a big parish that's in union with the diocese. It'll say it's under the diocese or whatever else like that. So I don't think it's as difficult to tell if it's SSPX or not.
The second part of that question, yes, is if your choice between a Norbis Ordo, which we just have no desire to attend, mm-hmm, or an SSPX, if it turns out that that's the only available Latin Mass.
Yes.
What would you...
obligation requirement.
Yes, it fulfills it. In fact, Bishop Felipe sent a letter to us all saying that it does fulfill it. But we need to, but we must dissuade them. We must encourage them to go to this, which I did even before I got that letter. We must encourage them. And so I know some SSPX people in town. I don't shun them. I don't tell them they have an invalid mass, but I do say we want you here.
The mass is fine to me. Do I need to confess that I went to...
No, no. You don't have to confess it.
I mean, it's a, you know...
No. No, you don't have to confess
it. I normally go there. I'm here.
No.
But it was an occasion that...
No, it's not...
I mean, is it a Catholic mass?
Yeah, it's a Catholic mass. Yeah, it's a Catholic mass. My understanding... Yeah, I'm 90% sure. Not 99. I'm 90% sure of this. If you're traveling... say to Alaska or Russia or something, and there's not a Catholic church, but there's only an Orthodox church, I think you can attend Divine Liturgy if you can't find a normal Catholic church, right?
I know that.
Yeah.
I know that for me.
Now, they won't let us receive Holy Communion there, even though it is the Lord's body and blood. The Orthodox won't let us, actually. And they actually, even though... at least the documents after Vatican II allow... we allow Orthodox, but... we do allow that, but they don't. The patriarchs and the metropolitans of the Eastern churches, unless they're Catholic churches, do not allow them to receive Holy Communion here in the Catholic churches. So does that kind of that gives you a little bit of an idea why my answer is not schismatic, that the church, even after Vatican II, says if you're in Alaska or Russia and can't find Mass, you can go to the Divine Liturgy. And it's a valid worship of the triune God. It's a holy sacrifice, right?
However, you qualify it if you can't find Norbis Ordo.
I know, so I didn't exactly answer your question. Well, I don't disagree with Bishop Felipe's answer. I think that's a good answer. It's just we dissuade them, but it's a valid Mass. So
that's helpful.
That's his answer, and that's my answer. So I agree. And did everybody hear what he said? He said, basically, he said, I wouldn't know the Latin Mass if it wasn't for Society of Pius X. And I agree with him, and here's why. I learned the Latin Mass from Fraternity St. Peter priests, and Fraternity St. Peter priests broke off from SSPX to become canonically regular 20 years ago. I can't remember when it was, 20 or 30 years ago. Part of these founding fathers of the SSPX came back into union with Rome under John Paul II, and they are the ones who taught me the Latin Mass. And so I have a friend, he's got 8 kids in SSPX, and he always reminds me, you wouldn't know that Mass if it wasn't for SSPX, and that's the only Mass I've done for 3 years. So whether you argue it was good or evil, God brings good out of evil, and it's obviously a good that we're all at the Latin Mass. So whether it was good or evil, the end game for us all is good. That's the beauty of it, and that's why I think Archbishop Lefebvre will be rehabilitated, but we also have to just kind of wait out the crisis in the church in a certain sense, too.
Thank you.
just to point out, Father, that this could obviously preach someone to become for Benedict.
Yes.
Did that?
Yes.
I read the exact same thing that you just said. That is
actually
society of Saints God, by the intent, we had to give a lot of gratitude to them for allowing us to be able to practice the liturgical at Mass today, because it was so, let's just say, looked down upon post-Vatican II.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then it wasn't really fully. Pope John Paul did a positive thing, and I can't speak eloquently about it, but knowing that it was a positive thing, but it wasn't all encompassing the whole church. It was when Pope Benedict did what he did, is when it made basically, not only you can do it, you should do it if you want to.
In modo proprio. Right. So this Mass that we just did, for a normal diocesan priest to do this Mass in the 70s was very, 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 very rare. And then John Paul II encouraged bishops to allow some latitude in the 1980s in that. And then in 2007, July 7th, 2007, Pope Benedict had a watershed document called Summorum Pontificum, giving every priest the ability to choose all the 1962 sacraments and the 1960 breviary without the permission of his bishop. However, public masses still needed the permission of the bishop, in which he was highly encouraged to always grant should there be pastoral need. That's the gist of Summorum Pontificum that came under Pope Benedict, 7th of July, 2007. And it was kind of a game changer for a lot of us, because it allows us to choose the old rite sacraments and blessings and exorcism, and you know that includes last rites, that includes everything. And again, a bishop is hard pressed to say no if there's pastoral need. He can't stop the priest from doing his own private daily Mass to be the traditional Latin Mass, also called the extraordinary form. In that document, it calls it the extraordinary form. And so that gave more rights to priests, at least for their own personal choice of the sacraments, if not pastorally. There's a watershed moment in the history of all traditionalists who go to this. So,
is there any significance of that date?
I think so. 777? Come on. Yeah.
It just disappoints me, Father, that we even have to spend time having this conversation.
Exactly. This is a sad conversation.
And I'm a dad.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that my kids, my family, we go where we're supposed to go, and I teach them the truth.
I agree.
And we're having to spend an hour to have you educate us.
Now, these are complex things, and it's... it's too bad. And I mean, I know a beautiful family that was at my ordination who used to go to Fraternity St. Peter Parish, and they moved to a different part of the country, and the Novus Ordo was so wacky, the whole family became Russian Orthodox. So it's like, what do you do? I mean, they have a liturgy that goes to the 6th century, a doctrine that goes to the 3rd century, or they can go to a guitar Mass. And what do? You know, they've gone Orthodox. And I don't think it was the right decision, but in a certain sense, their judgment must be lessened with all the craziness happening, you know? So it's a lot of the same thing when people go SSPX. A lot of them wanted to stay in a normal parish that was canonically regular, but felt they had no option, you know? And that's where, again, I agree with Bishop Felipe's letter. It's valid, but we should encourage them to come here because we are canonically regularized. Sounds like a medical issue. Yes.